can guarantee that you won't like what you see when you look closely. Self-obsessed, desperate to change what's always too weak, and once hope shined out from
to another exciting episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night at Planet FM 104.6 or live streamed at planetaudio.org.nz. Or listen to on the podcast, which I will be doing tomorrow. Hey, future Georgia, you're cool. You're going to kill it. That song was by a beautiful young woman called Estella from Nelson. She was the Smoke-Free Rock West solo duo winner of last year, 2018, and she has just released her debut release this week, which was that song we just listened to, funnily enough, called Break the Silence. It's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's on YouTube, the most stunning video ever, where she does these kind of cool dances, which if I did it, it would look ridiculous, but she does it and it just looks really stunning and cool and arty. So I definitely recommend going and having a look at that. But do it after the show, because we've got a really exciting show for you tonight. We're talking theatre. We're talking Fringe Fest, and also we do have an Auckland Arts Festival show coming up too, which is very cool. We haven't talked about Auckland Arts Fest this year, but it's coming up. I'm excited. Welcome to the studio, Ross.
Thank you very much.
How are you going? Could you tell us a bit about your show that is coming up?
Well, first off, I work as in a group, Muscle Mouth. There's four of us, and I make up sort of the choreography and sort of set design and, I guess, a certain artistic direction there. Mm-hmm. But I work with a lighting designer that I went to school with, actually, high school, funnily enough. So we've been working with each other for a long time. Natasha James and Melanie Hamilton, who is a producer slash dramaturg, and Jason Wright, who's a sonic artist and composer.
What's a sonic artist?
He makes lots of booms and scratches and sounds and recordings and sort of very scapic sound.
Cool.
He's going to hate me for saying that. I've got it all wrong. But, and a beautiful music, beautiful tunes. But,
But it sounds more than just music. It sounds an atmosphere.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's like he enhances a certain atmosphere of sounds, I suppose, and records a lot of different things, loops and creates big booms and he's extraordinary, actually. Yeah.
So the work that you're putting on is Muscle Mouth?
Yeah.
Muscle
Mouth. Okay. So
such
yeah.
A cool name.
Yeah, muscle being the body and mouth being the tongue and the word, I suppose, the spoken word. Yeah. And so we wanted to sort of I come from primarily a dance background, and but at the same time, I've been working away for a while, and I was working in sort of a very heavy dance theatre-based company in Belgium for about sort of 10 years. So I was really influenced by them. Mm-hmm. And coming back to New Zealand, we wanted to work together as a group. And, I guess the style we wanted to do was a bit hard to define. And so we just sort of looked at those two words, we narrowed it down, and the body and the muscle seemed to represent dance.
Yeah.
And, yeah. The Mouth Theatre, yeah.
Yeah, so it. So
that's
it,
the name
it's
of the company.
Dance and theatre. Yeah. It's like movement orientated. The pieces that you're putting on.
Yeah, it's very visual, in the sense that there's always a sculptural element to it. Like I used to be a builder before I was a dancer, and so I've always been into building sets and being part of that beginning of the design. Mm-hmm. So that's always been a huge trigger for me as far as working on the body or working with dance or working in theatre. It's been I quite often design and work with someone to build the set or an element of it first, and that that informs where the work might go or has a major impact in the space and choreography for me.
Cool. And the piece that you're putting on,
So As It Stands, as it's called, this is it's one of our biggest undertakings, I would say. Mm-hmm. It comes with it through the support of the Auckland Festival, and many other people have been also helping us out. And so this has been a project that we've been sort of chipping away at for maybe. I had a look this morning through a book, and I drew a picture of a dude holding a rock like that, and I realised that the drawing was from sort of 2016. So it's been a while, mm-hmm. Sort of factors coming together. But the work, as it stands, will premiere in March the 8th. And we have eight dancers that we've brought together for the piece, and we're sort of midway through rehearsals at the moment. Eight extraordinary dancers, I've got to say. A couple, three of them have come over from Australia. We held an audition for this work at the end of 2017, and it was really overwhelming how many people rocked up to it. And so that felt like a... that was really amazing for us as a small group to realise that, where we were sitting with interest, I suppose. And so we were quite overwhelmed by that. And it was really amazing to share that audition that just ended up kind of rolling into a two-day workshop. And, it was amazing starting place for this particular work. So from that, we got a cast of eight quite incredible dancers, but I sort of perhaps refer to them as interpreters, really. And so eight quite different, quite extraordinary in their own very virtuosic way. Yeah.
So what's the premise of the piece? Is it telling a story? Is there an idea around it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard at this point, but if I was to boil it right down, I took a trip up to Gibbs Farm and I took a stroll around a work called Te Tuhurangi Contour, which is a work by Richard Serra. And it's I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a sort of 6 metre high hunk of steel that weaves along for over 250 metres. And the conflict that I had with this piece was just rather instant. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this rusted behemoth thing that kind of jolts out of the green pastures and takes this weaving, curving shape of the surrounding hills. And it's so out of place and so striking that you can't help but gather a sort of a huge amount of chaos and motion. And you know, you'd say, like, can you look at one piece of sculpture and form an entire dance work? And I'd say, well, if you walk around it and it's 250 metres, potentially you could. Like, especially if you have this quite cathartic experience up against it and you walk around the corner and there's a sheep sitting next to it taking a dump. I mean, you know, it's a very odd, strange sort of environment to see this. And you can't help but, you know, have a fantasy with this work and go, yeah, I've got a caption in here in a book and I know where it's come from and I can read that and I can get the background of this. But if you strip that away and I came across this and we were none the wiser, then I just feel like it would change so much about the unknown and the curiosity it would cause and the, you know, like if you just didn't know that was there and you unearthed something and discovered that, I think the mind would go crazy. And so for me, there's perhaps a starting point there, yeah. And I guess just the hard, rusted steel and the gentle, fragile flesh of the body, I think it's a good combination. And I think perhaps rust weathers and so does skin and the way that it moves and how it makes you move and the fact, yeah. So there's a lot of coordinates attached to it. I see a tremendous amount of movement in his work. So this was what I would call the nucleus of this work, yeah.
I'm so curious. Just hearing you speak about it, it's like I feel very aware of my body all of a sudden.
Well, curiosity, I mean, it's an interesting one because for me, I think that's a massive thing within this work. And I would say that just recently I wrote something down where I thought, like, perhaps it's our Achilles heel as well as a beauty within us, because I think, yeah, it's that thing, isn't it? It's like there's a line that we've been using recently where it's like, I can't believe you touched that. I can't believe you touched that. And then I can't believe you couldn't, which is a conflict with a certain approach you take to something unknown or a sculpture or something. You know, some are just compelled to touch it, and others are really okay to stand back and not be affected and not affect it or not interrupt their story that they're having. And you know, So yeah, curiosity is huge, actually. Yeah,
great word. Great word. One of my favourites. Cool. Speaking of, not curiosity, but chaos, a word you mentioned just before, from the Best Directed Chaos last year, we had the Hobson Street Theatre Company in association with the Auckland City Mission put on an amazing piece last year at the Fringe Fest and are putting on another piece. Welcome, Peter, to the studio.
Kia ora.
How are you going?
Doing well.
Good weekend.
Yeah, it's been amazing, hasn't it? The sun.
What... You're here with That's What Friends Are For.
Yep, it's a devised piece and it's on at the basement for 5 nights. Mm-hmm. And we're working with 7 people who've either experienced being homeless or are currently homeless. And this time we're working with the street choir. So we've got 15 singers who are joining us on stage as well. It's a musical. It's a lot of people, a lot of chaos.
Yeah, chaos is such. It's another really great word.
Yeah, it is.
C words. Chaos. Curiosity. Sorry, I don't know where I'm going with that. So how do you select who's going to be a part of that? That must be quite a hard...
A call job. Goes... Well...
Because I imagine there'll be quite a few people interested in being a part of something like that. And also, like, I know that you've got a bit of a rep for putting on really amazing... shot.
Yeah, it's the first time I've directed them, mm-hmm. and I was really excited about being asked to do that because mm-hmm. of the quality of the work that's gone before, and I was really keen to build on, you know, on that past record. There's a lot of there's a couple of the cast who've been there right from the beginning, which is 10 years.
Wow.
Which is a long time for any theatre company, let alone a theatre company made up of homeless or people who've been homeless. So we have those sort of stalwarts who are still there. Kelly, who does the most amazing eyebrow movement of anyone I've ever seen on any stage in my life, and an extraordinary pitch when he sings. It's just fantastic. Shadow, who's, I don't know how old Shadow is, but I think, you know, he's been living on the street for at least 20 or 30 years, and he's a central part of our show. What we're really interested in is bringing on a younger crew of homeless people as well. This particular cast have been together for quite some time, and I think there's two or three new ones in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why is it that you're wanting to bring in a younger cast?
Simply, I think, because it's around mentoring to a kind of tainer kinds of relationships.
Yeah,
so it's about the skills and the knowledge that this cast has developed and this particular crew have developed over a number of years, and how you can bring that on and sustain that with new and younger homeless people.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Is this the first year that you have worked with the choir as well?
Yeah, it's the first time the company's worked with a choir.
Was that what came first, the choir or the musical aspect, like the idea of it being a bit?
I don't know, and it's really interesting because it's a devised piece, and I guess I wasn't aware of how much musical talent there was in the cast. We've been rehearsing up at St. Matthew's Church with a piano in there, and we were just having a break and sitting around the piano, and suddenly we started singing, and it was kind of like, oh, I think this could be a musical.
That's so cool. I'm so curious about it. It reminds me of, do you remember seeing that program came out of Australia? Would it be maybe 12 or 13 years ago now? Choir of Hard Knocks?
I don't remember it.
You'd love it. I'll look it up. I'll look up the details. But it's this, he's like a really famous musical theatre guy, and he mentors choir of homeless people, or people that are just kind of been a bit down on their luck, and you have some absolutely stunning singers that they start to sing, you just cry, and then some singers that just want to be a part of it and kind of disrupt the whole flow of it. So it's like, it's funny, but it's great, and it's heartwarming, and it's I'll look at the details because I'm kind of getting this is great. Okay, cool. That's what friends are for. So you mentioned before in the green room, which is this room, by the way, for everyone in the room. It's a red room, green room, that it's about making friends over the course of an hour.
So one of the things about being homeless is you pretty friendless in lots of ways in terms of the public discourse, especially in Auckland, you know, because of the large numbers, and it's a pretty unfriendly environment for homeless people to live in. And paradoxically or ironically, whatever the word is, it's also where to survive on the street, you have to make friends.
Yeah.
So one of the things about being homeless that you are an expert in, that you know a hell of a lot about, is friendship. And the cast tell incredible stories of what it is to be a friend, what it is to have a real friend, what it is to have a street friend. And I think it's one of the things that I've always loved about this particular company. It might be made up of people who are homeless, but they don't tell stories about being homeless. Who wants to tell that story? But what they do tell stories about is other stuff that they know about.
Yeah.
You know, and what they know about is how to be a human with other human beings, how to accept others, how to kind of wander around a very alienating city and feel very cut off by it, and how do you survive in there? And that's a message beyond homelessness. It's actually, you know, a very human story. And I think, you know, the show, that's what friends are for, really asks the question, what are friends for? who needs them?
Yeah.
And why do we need them, and how do we make them, and those kinds of things.
That's I love that idea of having the people who are telling the story be the experts within that. The idea that they're putting out there. Have they written the piece or been a part of writing the piece?
They've written the whole thing. So we devise. Yeah. So we kind of make it up as we go, and then we script.
Okay.
And it's been a really interesting process, because we've worked, I guess, for about 2 or 3 months. We've just played with ideas, and then we've had to put an aesthetic structure around to kind of make sense of it as a piece of theatre. So we've then written it, sort of kind of made it stuck. This is what we're working with, and then immediately broken it again. So it's kind of like play, put it together, make a structure with it, and then deliberately undermine it again, and do that for as many times as you can before opening night, and then just work out what happens when it goes live.
So it's still a little, like, have you got a structure and a script that you think you're going to stick to, or is it still a little bit... You're seeing how it's going to...
No, we have now, and it's really cool, actually. It's lovely. And we'd be... the structure, basically, is it's an old trope, really, in theatre. A director turns up without a cast, and who'd trust homeless people to turn up to put on a show. And with the audience and the cast, we put on a show.
Yeah. Is that a challenge with homeless people in terms of... I'm trying really hard for this not to come across in a patronising way, but I can imagine that actually not having a fixed place for you to base your life around, it must be hard to make things like rehearsals sometimes. Do you find it's a bit of a challenge, or not as much as one might expect?
Well, I was the one who was late the other day because I got stuck in bloody traffic. So...
How did that go down?
It's the first time in months, and like they were all there early. Today was a bit tough. It was a hot day. We were supposed to be there at 4 o'clock, and I guess we kicked off at about 20 past, and it usually means one of the cast. We have one person, I won't mention her name, who is always late, but we have another cast member who always rings her. She comes down, she's in. And away we go.
Yeah. To be honest, that would be me. I'm constantly like, half an hour.
Yeah,
late,
but you know, I've directed.
Day.
I've directed lots of shows, and there's always one.
Anyone late to your show? Because there's only the two of you, isn't it? So Fringe Fest, you are putting on Go Home Curry Muncher, which, by the way, I find really uncomfortable to say.
I guess, like the title, it's quite a bold, unapologetic show. And we're also trying to reclaim that slur, but we're also going to decolonize MasterChef in our show.
So, yeah, MasterChef is like it's basically like all white male judges. And they're just like telling these Asian chefs like how to cook their own food better, and that they should stick to their own cuisine and not venture into Western cuisine. And so we want to reclaim that show and show what it's like for like two angry women of color to take over it. Yeah.
That sounds so good. That sounds a bit chaotic.
It is.
Yeah?
Very chaotic and very full of feminine wrath and rage.
Yeah. I love that. Literally the first line on the Fringe little write-up about it is, angry woman smashing coconuts in a heated MasterChef-style competition. I'm sold.
Yeah, it's very much performance art-based, and sort of we structured it around experimental theatre, so we incorporated art poetry because we come from a performance poetry background. Mm-hmm. So we've structured it around our poems, and we've added a bit of like skit style comedy to it while also including performance art with the poetry. So it is all over the place, but it does come back to the core, which is the reclaiming of the identity and commenting on the microaggressions of racism and that...
And the... Europeanization of Asian cuisine.
Yeah. So how was it that this idea came about? Like, were you watching MasterChef together? Or that's literally, was it? I just got a nod.
Yes, we were definitely watching MasterChef. And Ira had mentioned that chefs were telling these contestants how to cook their own cuisine. And it's hilarious to think about that, how someone could judge.
Yeah, how, like, you know, like, sometimes they, like, they say that, oh, actually, they give, like, the best Asian dish to a white person, a white chef who just cooked it. And over
the Asian contestant.
Yeah, so it's, like,
ironic. Problematic.
Yeah.
It just stabs you in the heart, like, I gotta do something about this. Yeah.
So we took to the stage.
How have you found the people's response to that?
To the MasterChef decolonization?
Yeah, to like the idea that you've come up with. Like, I work in events. I'm a woman who works in events, and I find that people like to tell me a lot that I don't have the experience that I actually have.
Mm.
Yeah, have you found that at all, or have people been like defensive of MasterChef, or have people been like, hell yeah, great idea? Like, I was like, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
See it straight away.
I haven't encountered anyone who's been defensive. A lot of people usually, when we bring it up, think, oh yeah, I never thought about it like that. Or, oh yeah, that's so interesting if you look at it from that perspective. And I think it's just because that perspective hasn't necessarily been told, or we haven't heard about it from our perspective.
Yeah.
So I think it is a nuanced idea.
Yeah.
And now when we talk about it, then people kind of talk about other aspects of food and who should cook it, and then it seeps into other forms of cultural appropriation and where the line is and is there a line. And so it does garner more discussion than we had initially anticipated. Yeah.
It's just a 30-minute piece. Have you... Is it? That's right?
Yeah, that's 30 minutes.
Yeah. So you've put...
It's explosive.
A lot of chaos within half an hour.
Yeah, well, we wanted to do that because we come from more of a poetry background than necessarily a theatre background. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to risk it and bore people. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot to say, and I think putting it in 30 minutes really gives us the opportunity to just go bam, 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 in your face, now go away and see how you feel about it.
Yeah. Do you see it as a piece as well that might continue to develop? Like, you might try it in a few different ways? No?
Yes. Yeah, so this is like the first time we're putting on like our own show. So I guess it's like 30 minutes. It's just like, it's like a trial for us.
Yeah.
And I think if we get like good feedback, we would definitely try to make it a longer show.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because it is koha entry, we do want to make it accessible to people who don't usually go to theatre, especially people of colour and from the migrant community and children of migrants. That audience doesn't necessarily go to theatre as much. So for us to put on something that's koha entry, it does mean that more of the audience can become accessible to theatre. And now with Fringe, we're seeing a lot of people of colour telling their stories and reclaiming their own culture through art, and hopefully we can bring more people to the theatre in that way.
Absolutely. We had the woman from Proudly Asian Theatre in last week talking about their show Tide Waits for No Man, and I was just checking whether the dates collided, but they don't, because my favourite thing about Fringe is doubling up on your Fringe shows, or tripling up, or quadrupling it forth, isn't it? Yeah. Just seeing as many Fringe shows in one night as you possibly can. But it doesn't. But people could go from the 19th to the 23rd to go see Tide Waits for No Man, and then they could come on the 1st or the 2nd
to see
Go Home Curry Muncher.
Exactly.
Which is both shows of Asian women telling stories from their perspective.
Yes. And you can also go from...
That's What Friends Are For.
That's What Friends Are For, straight into Go Home Curry Muncher and have a meal after that, perhaps.
What an evening.
What an evening. Get spices thrown at you after making friends with some people. What an evening.
We go to get spices thrown at us?
You may or may not.
Sounds so... When I first started... I've been doing the show Kick Ass for... it must be... Yeah, a bit over 3 years now. And Richard started asking me to do reviews of theatre, and I hardly been to any theatre. I was like, I'm really like, I'm a music. I went to shows all the time, like music shows, but never theatre. And it's been like a bit of a roller coaster from starting being like hating audience participation, sitting at the back, and now I go and I'm like right in the middle at the front. I'm like all about it. Because I think it was just, it took a little bit of being, now I know it's safe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always going to be safe. I hope you can participate in our show because we do have a bit of audience participation.
Yeah.
And why not come with your eyes full of surprises, because we will throw unexpected things at you and do unexpected things.
Yeah. And you're also, so you are at Basement Theatre. Where is, that's what friends are for?
Yep.
At Basement Theatre too?
At Basement Theatre.
Ah, are you both in the same?
Yeah. So you can literally come out of That's What Friends Are For and sweep into Go Home Curry Manjo.
Oh,
yeah.
You're both in the, you're in the other theatre.
No.
We're in the car park.
You're in the same, you're in the car park.
Yeah. We're in the car park, honey.
This is so cool.
I know, tell
I've
me
never
about
seen
it.
Anything in the car park there.
Hashtag fringe.
Oh, man, that's so cool. Sorry, also, welcome to the studio after half an hour. Sorry, Todd.
That's
welcome
all right.
to the studio. It's Kia really ora. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
I've been feeling your vibe. The audience has been feeling your vibe.
Amazing. That's what we want, right?
Yeah. So Todd is here to co-host.
Yes. Just listening at the moment, because everyone is saying great things and I don't feel like I have much to add, but throughout the next hour, watch me go, team. It's going to be wild.
Well, that is why I love to host, but my favourite is co-hosting, because I just get to sit there and kind of just
intently
just sit there
listen.
And smile, and then I go and see cool things. Are you doing anything to do with Fringe, or just going to Fringe shows?
Just going to Fringe shows.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I have put Go Home Curry Muncher in my calendar because I'm ready.
I've noticed that every single Fringe event that I've gone to click attending on, you have already clicked attending.
I'm a busy bee.
Yeah. But also, I just think that's cool. Like, just because, you know, like, the more people that click attending to things, then the more it turns up on people's news feeds.
Yeah.
So I always do that. Like, I've got a friend who puts on drum and bass shows, and I will never, ever, ever go to even one of those.
Amazing.
But I always click attending, as if I will, because it's just,
Also, because I'm a producer, I, like, it's just so great if someone clicks attending to the event you're trying to promote, because you're like, oh, that's at least 75% likely it's going to turn into a ticket sale, and we all need those, so, yeah.
On that note, do you want to talk about your show coming up on Thursday?
Oh,
just because I just think it's chance. So cool. I'm so excited.
So I produced The Water Cooler, and we're coming back for 2019. We're doing a Pride special called The Secret Lives of Drag, and we're featuring three storytellers who are drag performers, and they're going to be spilling all the tea about their experiences working in that art form and how they found it, how it found them, and how people in their lives have reacted to it, all that kind of jazz. Yeah.
That's great. I'm so excited. I'm going to be there. People should come and hang out with me and my sisters. We bond. We've started doing drag makeup, but we don't leave the house with it, obviously, because, like, it's...
You could come to the show in it.
One of my sisters is very keen for it. I would just... Yeah, you know, I don't want people to think that we're ridiculous, because we're, like, not... Like, I don't want people to think that we're trying to claim something that's not ours. You
right,
know what I mean?
Yeah,
I want to be
100%.
Sensitive. Yeah. I want to be as sensitive, yeah.
Yeah.
But we do enjoy watching Drag Race in my sister's house.
Yeah.
And, like, eating pizza and putting on fake eyelashes.
Amazing.
And I feel like everyone's probably down for that. Appreciation, not appropriation.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's what I'm all about. Were you at Big Out today?
No, I wasn't. I worked at the warehouse, so that's who had my presence instead of the big gay out, which was a sad time. But I went to the Pride March yesterday, and it was awesome. It was really, really, really cool.
I didn't go to the Pride March, but I did go to Big Out, and it was awesome, and there were some amazing drag queens.
Yeah.
Everyone should go follow... Do you follow Miss Wednesday Blaisel on Instagram?
No.
Everybody should go follow Miss Wednesday Blaisel on Instagram. I know Blaise through Kick Arts. And in that time, Blaise has become a really beautiful drag queen, and I just spent most of the time kind of hiding in the shadows, just looking at Blaise doing lip syncing, thinking, you're amazing. That's my whole story. Thanks. I've got a question for the room. Do you? It seems as though the one of the shared threads between what we are all talking about tonight in terms of all the different pieces is that there seems to be some sort of a message or something that's being explored through it. Do you think that that's important or necessary in the art that we put on, in theatre that we put on, like that there is something that's being discussed, or is it okay for like art just to be for art's sake? Or I don't think that there's a right answer. I just love hearing people's thoughts on it, if anyone has any thoughts.
I always think art is political. I guess that's what attracts me personally to art. Or maybe I just try and find meaning in something. And I think as humans, we always try and find meaning in something. And maybe it depends on the background that we come from or the experiences that we have. Usually they are social and political. And maybe it's just innately that we draw meaning from things. But I think it does help to, when you're passionate about something and you use that to fuel your story or to fuel the way that you tell a story, I think it is helpful because you do want it to be meaningful. I guess for me and for what we're trying to do, you want it to resonate with audiences and you want them to go away feeling a certain way. For me, it tends to be political, but I don't know. It could be not political for other people.
Yeah. Is your go-to to try to do that in quite a fun way? Because it sounds as though the show that you're doing, it sounds incredibly fun.
Yeah, definitely. Like we don't want it to be
nods coming from that side of the room.
We don't want it to be preachy for sure.
Yeah.
So we're just like, poking fun at ourselves. Yeah.
Because in our everyday lives, we definitely laugh at ourselves. And so we want to bring that to the stage as well through our personas, through our stage personas. And we do find a lot of humour in the things that we experience. Even the political stuff, there is a lot of humour to it. Yeah. So we definitely want to...
In a lot of the racist things that people say to us, they can be quite funny and silly sometimes,
And you do have to laugh at it. And I think bringing a humorous lens to often serious situations helps diffuse awkwardness and tensions and is a great way for it to make it relatable and universal to people who maybe don't have the same experiences that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So we do want to infuse that into the show and make sure that we deliver something that's bold and punchy.
Yeah.
But underneath it all, there is subtext to it.
Yeah. Like there's a take-home message.
Yeah.
But you can go and have fun with it.
You can still think, you can still definitely go and have fun if you like things being thrown at you and you like aromas of turmeric and banana curry. You could still definitely appreciate one or the other or both. That was the intention.
And we're cooking food for the audience.
That's really cool. Okay, I do have a question that's it's related but kind of unrelated. What is banana curry?
So banana curry is green bananas that you grate or you chop up and you put it in a dish and you add turmeric and grated tomatoes and onions and you leave it to simmer for a couple of minutes and then that's your meal and you can have it cold or hot. And so for me, I guess why I'm promoting banana curry is my mom would always cook banana curry for me to take to school at high school when I first came to New Zealand. And that was an experience of culture clash and the whole integration assimilation aspect. So we're putting that into our show because we're giving people the opportunity to eat it and hopefully feel what it's like to be in our shoes, experiencing that world, the two worlds of the West and the East. Like and it's
experiential
also,
learning.
Yeah, and it's also delicious. And also my mom might be proud that I'm... showing her recipe on stage to a bunch of people.
How cool.
Yeah.
That's so good. I remember going to a little, what are they called? You know when they do like a little taster of a show? Taster. Of a Living Large with Marge. And Marge gave us all, who is drag queen, gave us all like little cheese rolls to take away. And I didn't have anything in my house for dinner. So then I went home and I like put the cheese roll in the oven. And I just remember that being real cool and real sensory and like had the instructions and I just, like, it was cool.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes theatre fun is being immersed in the experience. So I know we really enjoy like participatory theatre and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to make this show more participatory than us telling the story, because then it almost becomes preachy.
Yeah.
And so to experience the aromas hopefully brings people to a better understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter, I saw on the photo for That's What Friends Are For, that there are two men having a hungy. And is your show interactive? It just made me think for a second that that might be...
Yeah, there are moments where we end up in the audience and then the audience end up with us.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, this notion of the arts and messages, I think messages are quite useful in envelopes or in... something you post online, but I don't think they have much to do with art or the arts, to be honest. Plays or theatre shouldn't be about things. They should be made of things, and that's quite different. So this play isn't about homeless people. Mm. It's made of homeless people wanting to wrap you in an experience that makes you think and feel and be excited and moved and changed and shifted. So it's got all that about it. And I think I'm always really nervous of well-intentioned, well-meaning, you know, and I'm not big, you know, of well-intentioned, well-meaning pieces of art, because usually they're pretty dull. Because you have to give something away.
Yeah.
Because art to me is ambiguous. There's shades rather than black and whites, and I don't have. The one thing I can say about our play is it's, you know, I'd agree with you about the politics of art or the politics of theatre. Having a theatre company made up of people who live on the streets of this city is a political statement in and of itself, regardless of what we do.
Yeah.
It's about homeless people making something beautiful, a piece of art, something which we experience at a very sensory level, is deeply politically challenging to a class of people who demonise people who live on the street.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you think that it's possible to have art without it being political?
I don't know how you can be alive and not be political. Yeah. So one level, people who say they're not political, they might as well be dead. The world we live in, I mean, at the time we live in, God almighty, you know, I mean, you have to be political. We're on the edge of chaos, the edge of nothingness, and if you want to be apolitical about that, how could you know? We live in a country that's intensely racist, founded on colonization, which has destroyed much hyper capitalism, which preys on people. We have a whole bunch of things. If you want to be apolitical, you might as well just kind of curl up and go away. Which is also, you know, so the arts.
There's a room of smiles. Of agreement, I presume. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, I don't think you could be anything but political now, can you? How could you be?
So how does art not be political in that it doesn't, like, intrinsically have a message?
I think you were talking about it with your show.
Mm.
When it's kind of something that you take and you hammer over the head, you know, don't be racist or whatever, that's not art.
Right.
But the show that you were talking about, which is a sensory experience and you get to have all this other kind of thing. So the anti-racism is not what the play is about, but it's what it's made of.
Mm.
It's right. Made of the extraordinary story of these two young women who know deeply what racism is because they live in New Zealand. so that's what the play's made of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily about that. By the sound of it, it sounds like a hell of a lot of fun where you're chucking spices at people.
It's about cooking and all these other elements. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I agree about the about how do you separate politics in a way. I mean, maybe I think that it can be it's incredibly personal. I think people have a lot of internal politics happening throughout them, firing through their body. Obviously, some less than others, and I think it can cause all sorts of internal politics and reactions. And so, even if it's not coming out or if it's not being represented in your work, I think you're feeling it and seeing it. And I'd say, you know, so I can relate to that to a degree with politics, but I would say my works might not necessarily reflect that, or the works that Muscle Mouth have done aren't bringing politics or dealing with that, but they're most definitely negotiating internal politics, because I think that's, you know, and I think dance does that a lot, to be honest. And I think I'm really interested in the internal politics of your indecision, for example. I know that might sound really abstract, but I think choices are attached to that, and I think that can be a very broad, that can be taken quite broadly. And it, you know, if I think messages, for me, if I think about our works or even where we're at this very point, perhaps we haven't built our work to a specific message or what we want to deliver just yet. And I always think it's pretty interesting how you start with that maybe as a tangent or something that might come across, and how that disappears and new ones arrive, and how you almost end up having no control over that anyway. So I've learned to, I sort of feel like I don't want to begin with something that I would feel too precious about, because I feel like I'm only going to end up disappointed. That message not going to be specific or come across anyway. And it's interesting when I look at dancers that I'm working with and realizing that the different politics or messages that they bring in to the studio every single day, and if a task or even in, you know, my experience in theatre, the way you feel inherently reflects and changes how you interpret something anyway. So
yeah.
I really agree about the politics thing. I think, I actually, weirdly, I had a conversation with my dad this morning. We don't talk art that much. And we talked about politics and art, and he said it's like sex and religion, mate. You can't separate it. So I don't know what that's about. But so he, and I thought that was, he can give these offhanded comments like that, and I always take them and think, was that genius or was that just him? I'm not sure. So, you know, I have to maybe think about it. Yeah, yeah. So I have to think about that. But yeah,
I think we were talking just before we went on air that you know, when you start making something, if you aim towards a message, you soon work out that's not actually going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
Things fall out of the making, and actually, if you're lucky, you follow things that happen by chance, by accident. You kind of go, oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we all know that we've been in the room to start with a great message and a great thing to go down, and I think that's the, even when you pick up a pen to draw something, unless you're not tracing it, it's like you have an idea of what it's going to be. It never is that. I'm not saying that that's not the way to step into it, and it's great to have a string of, you know, a particular thing there, but it's that thing of, like, I think how you hold on to it or how you come back to it or what you let spiral off from it, I think that's really key, I reckon.
Yeah.
Yeah. How loosely, no, not how loosely, maybe how you hold on to that message from the beginning to the end, and where you weigh them up as if they're the same, or from the beginning of the process to the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense, maybe?
It totally does, yeah. And yeah. I really relate to what you were saying before, Peter, about things being like different shades of grey and things not being black and white.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, it's really hard to, probably even like impossible for anything in this whole world to be without contradiction in some way.
Well, I think that's what, you know, like simple messages, like say no, you know, like the say no to drugs thing, hugely damaging, you know, like ended up chucking whole generations of black people in jails in the United States because it was a simple message that was a crap message. So, you know, all those kinds of things, because life has all, life and art is just full of all these kinds of contradictions and complexities, and it's actually just sometimes just sitting inside all those kinds of things and listening to you talk about your show. And, you know, sometimes when people are racist, it's funny. Well, is there a message in that, or is it just kind of like something for us to think about, to kind of play with. I really want to see this show.
What do you think, Todd?
I was just listening to everyone talk about their thoughts on it. It occurred to me that maybe not all art is made with a message, but I think all art makes a statement. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the art that I make as a writer or an actor often comes from a place of thinking about the message or statement it's going to make, because it's usually queer work. And I think, inherently in making work of that nature, it has a message or it becomes political or has a statement because it is a marginalized voice taking space. I think all work is saying something, whether or not it is decided to pointedly say that thing.
Yeah. Do you think that's something to strive for? Like, to be empowered by? Or is just something that kind of happens organically? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's incredibly empowering. Just personally for me as an artist, the season is still running, actually, of the Legacy Project, but I have a short play that's in it, and seeing words that I've written that deal with these queer characters on stage and are being consumed by the general public is like, oh my god, that's insanely cool and super empowering to see that people want to see that kind of work and hear those kinds of stories.
Yeah. So at Big Gay Out today, there, John Lemon was performing, and he wrote the song a couple of years ago when I was going through a really, really hard time with my mental health, and he had the song, which isn't out anymore, but I'm going to message him and see if he's going to release it again, called When It Came Along. And it was about, like, everybody in the world having this moment where they realised that it was okay to just be who you are, and for people just to, like, accept each other no matter where they were at, wherever. And I remember listening to that song in my car on repeat, and it actually, like, pumping me up and, like, getting me through job interviews and stuff, and feeling like the message or the statement behind that song was really significant to me at that moment, and hearing a story that wasn't what you hear in, like, every single song on the radio. I don't know, that's just what you made me think of then. On that note, I'm actually going to play a song, and everyone can have a little break. Go to the bathroom if they want, have a drink of water, whatever you want, it's up to you. I'm going to play a song by a band called Death Cab for Cutie. They are from Seattle, and they are coming to play at the Auckland Arts Festival, and I am so excited. I've got front row seats. This is a song called Gold Rush, which is about, well, really it's about capitalism. It's about going home to Seattle and seeing how beautiful old buildings have been torn down and replaced, and, you know, they become apartment blocks, and, you know, old cafes become, I don't know, stores to sell cell phones or something. It's about, like, you know, culture being replaced with capitalism, I guess. But it's a really beautiful song, and it's a little ironic because I think last time they came and played, they played at the St. James, and the St. James has been torn down. Is it becoming apartment blocks?
They're working on trying to save it by building apartment blocks above it, I believe.
But the St. James is going to come back?
It's all up in the air, and there's been multiple campaigns over the last couple of years. I follow it on Facebook.
I'm going to go have a little look so we can see. Well, let's be inspired by the song to save the St. James. I don't know what I'm talking about. So here is Gold Rush by Death Cab for Cutie.
Down, so that the cops can live underground. The swinging of a racket. know. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. Staring at the ceiling in the dark, same old empty feeling in your heart. Cause love comes slow and it goes so fast. Will you see her when you fall asleep? But never to touch and never to keep. Cause you loved her too much and you dive too deep. Will you only need the light when it's burning low? Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let.
There's too many things that I can't remember. As I disappeared like a trend, and the hum of the five in the early morning. And now I'm taking my time up through Coalinga, through the valley. This highway lived in my mind, and it takes me back to the place that made me. Face you, no room in frame for two. You cannot outrun a ghost, speeding southbound lanes with the abandon. It catches you on the coast of the Palisades. You killed the engine, and then it hovers above. Reeling bodies failing to discover a thing they once knew as love, raising their voices to convince one another. Design your way when the cameras turn to face you. We'll be right back.
welcome back to the studio. I've got a slight apology to make for those who have been listening for the past few minutes. Turns out when I opened up my laptop, it just shifted to the last thing that I was listening to on my laptop, and it also started playing from my laptop. So there was about a 5-second silence, and then we started listening to Passenger, which is actually quite uncool. So a little punishment for me, but yeah. So we listened to half of... which song was it?
Gold Rush.
Gold Rush. Thank you, Todd.
You're welcome.
You've earned your spot. Yeah. Gold Rush by Death Cab for Cutie. Then we listened to the second half of Passenger. What's the song called?
Let It Go? Question mark?
Let her go. Yeah. Man, you're good. And then we listened to No Room in Frame, also by Death Cab for Cutie, which is a great song. It's about Zooey Deschanel. People like to tell me that I look like her, and I definitely don't, but I definitely will take that compliment because she is a beautiful lady, and she's also cool and quirky.
She is. I agree.
Cool. So we've got half an hour left of the show. I'm hoping this is long enough for the next 20 minutes or so before we go into shameless promotion, because I would really love to hear the stories of how the four or five of you got into the arts, like, and what made you want to do theatre or dance or do something artistic not autistic. That was a what's the word when you say something, not a typo,
slip of the tongue.
Yeah, but how hilarious was it that my brain wanted to say typo? Is it
when talking about, yeah, a slip of the tongue? Amazing.
Jumishka, you looked like you had a bit of a... You did the startled eyes at me when I asked about your journey. Does that mean that you've got a great journey to tell?
Well, I was just thinking about it. I guess for me, I've always loved art and I've always been creative ever since I was little. And I think self-expression for me is the best form of freedom. Mm-hmm. And I love theatre, but I think I love interactive theatre and theatre that resonated with me personally and, like, my identity and the things that I've experienced living in New Zealand. So I started off with poetry, and I started writing poetry ever since I was little. And then my friend Iowa was like, you should perform your poetry. And then I got up the courage to perform it. I think I started performing last year, or the beginning, or the end of the year before.
This is something so recent.
Yeah. Mm. So I just recently started performing poetry, and we became friends through that. And we had a lot of things in common, both I and myself, the poetry and the things we wanted to talk about, the politics, the feminism. And I loved how bold and unapologetic Iowa's voice was in her poetry. And I think that journey has led us to create this beautiful, bold piece of work that we've always wanted to put something together, and now we can do that. And we've also tutored poetry workshops with Shakti Youth. So that as well has also fueled...
What is that?
So Shakti is a women's refuge organization. Oh. And the youth sector helps build and empower and gives tools to young women who come from migrant backgrounds to use in their own personal journey. So we've done a poetry workshop with them. They also do other things like dance and leadership, workshops. And so we've connected with them. We've also done workshops with Renee Liang, who's one of our biggest supporters through this. She's given me the courage to perform poetry as well. So
For me, I've only started getting to the arts about the same time as Jumishka. Yeah, just like over a year ago. And so I only moved to Auckland about 3 years ago. And it was only recently that I started getting into the arts, because came here with I met my Kiwi partner in Bangkok, and then we came here and I was all alone, didn't have any family or friends. So I was what should I do with my life? Yeah, and so I saw like this call out on Facebook from a friend, Alice Canton. I didn't know her then, but she had this show called Other Chinese. She was doing a call out to all Chinese people who would like to be in a show, and you don't have to have any theater experience. So I was like, oh yeah, that sounds cool. So I just jumped on it, and through that I started getting to the art. So it was like a show for Chinese people to tell their stories on stage, and I did some like of my own poetry on stage. So that's how I got into the arts.
So have you, and you've been friends just through
the arts?
Through the arts.
Yeah, you can make friends through the arts. And it's great because we,
that's what friends
And we've done a couple of writing workshops together, and I think we stayed connected through that. And we've realized our passion mutually is to make people uncomfortable sometimes through our poetry. Yeah, that's our, that's kind of our journey to get here where we are.
Cool. Uncomfortable in what way? Like in like a disrupting a thought pattern, or like uncomfortable because you just think it's funny to make someone feel a bit cringy?
Maybe a bit of both, I don't know. Can we do that? But yeah, uncomfortable in disrupting thought pattern, because
yeah,
we do want to address a lot of issues, and we do naturally. I think the way we write, the style of our poetry addresses a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It can be quite confrontational and provocative in the most playful way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where is it that people can perform poetry in Auckland?
In Auckland? Right now there's such a huge surgence of performance poetry and slam poetry.
Really?
Yeah, it's great to see. There's Jaffa, which is a Facebook group, and you can, and they have open mic nights. I think it's every month. They do open mic nights out East Auckland, West Auckland, North Shore. And so if you have something to share, you can just go up and share. And then every session they have a guest poet. And you've been a guest poet before, haven't you, Iowa?
Yeah, so they do it at like different libraries. Like they have North Shore Library, and they have one out east,
Te Oro Glenis.
Yeah.
And K Road at Merge Cafe, they do open mic nights there.
At Merge?
Yeah, at Merge.
Cool. Man, Merge is so cool.
Merge is great. I think it's Thursday nights.
Yeah. Then they do some at the Thirsty Dog, so I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. That's Poetry Live. That's like the longest poetry performance. Yes.
That was the only one I knew of. I didn't know that this is a thing.
No, it's a it's a huge thing. It's everywhere. There's heaps of Facebook groups. There's SUP poetry as well.
Like SUP?
SUP. And Action, I think Action Education promotes that poetry. So it's around, and I think that's how we were able to promote our voices through that.
Awesome. So if this is like just been like a year or so, I cannot wait to see like you come back and like tell us about like another show you're doing like in a few months, and then like next year, and then like in 4 years' time, and it's gonna be like this great journey. I'm so excited.
We're performing in Wellington as well.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
At the Performance Arcade.
When is that?
21st to 24th of March.
Cool.
So, it's a free show.
Cool. So people can note that down, but also in 10 minutes' time, we're going to do a shameless promotion where you're going to share all those details again.
Thank you.
Peter, so you're a director, but have you been involved in the arts in other ways as well? Like, what's been your journey to get to this point?
I'm a little bit older than most people in the room, so my journey's kind of a little bit scattergunned. I grew up in an Irish Catholic home, so it was full of ritual and singing mass, rosary, a whole, you know, all that kind of part of the arts, mm-hmm. which is, you know, sort of deeply part of a spiritual kind of who you are. Because it was Irish, it was full of story and history and singing and dance and poetry and novels. Story was always something that we honoured and cherished in our house. My dad was the most extraordinary storyteller. I can remember as a teenager my friends coming around to listen to Dad tell stories because he could weave a story. I mean, he just was able to do it. He was Irish. He could do that kind of thing. I went to England because as a young man, there was a woman called Dorothy Heathcote who was probably the world's greatest drama teacher. And I studied with her. And I started working, making theatre in prisons in the UK and spent a long time doing that. I've done a doctorate in using theatre in places like forensic psychiatric wards. So I actually did theatre in the Mason Clinic just around the corner from the studio. I've made theatre in earthquake zones, made theatre in pretty much just about everywhere. And I'm really interested, I guess, in the whole business of how theatre can become a democratic process where everyone gets a chance to tell a story. That's what I loved about growing up. We never thought of it as art or culture or anything like that. It was just, you know, it was a poor Irish Catholic family, and we just, art and culture and life and politics were definitely all weaved in together. It was just breathing. I didn't find art. I was just born into it, and I've lived it all my life.
Yeah. Do you think when you were growing up, did you envision yourself doing the kind of work that you're doing now, or is it just kind of happened organically as you've...
I've only ever lived organically. I've stumbled on things, ended up doing stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of some sort of... I think it's why I'm so sort of nervous about messages. I'm nervous about outcomes. I'm nervous about... I haven't had too many goals in my life, and I kind of avoid them if I can.
Has your journey in doing theatre with so many different people having so many different experiences, has that made you quite a natural fit, do you think, to the work that you're doing now, working with people who it's probably quite
don't
safe
fit either
to presume are having, you know, have had some tough experiences or are having tough experiences?
Yeah, I think the arts have a way of making us feel more fully human, if that makes sense. And they connect us to something inside ourselves and then beyond ourselves at the same time. And we live in a world where that's often cut off from people, where they can't connect to those really deep human impulses.
Mm.
And the arts provide a bridge to that. They provide a bridge into the past, and they provide a bridge into the future, and they provide bridges across to other people.
Mm.
And that's what I've always been interested in, and especially I think with groups where the bridges have been blown up. Where they've been blown up either deliberately. So homeless people, their bridges have been blown up.
Mm.
People in earthquake zones, the world's tumbled away underneath them, and the Mason Clinic, all those kinds of places, and not how the arts can stitch them back together or kind of fix things, but just how they sometimes can give some joy and light and those sorts of things.
And that way, do you find that beyond it being storytelling and an opportunity for people to... explore that story and share their and have a platform to share their voice. Is it therapeutic in any way as well?
Well, it depends on what you mean by therapy. If therapy is meaning making, like how do you make meaning out of your life, which is different to how you fix something, if therapy is about making meaning, the arts are a process of making meaning, it seems to me. Yeah.
For me, absolutely, it's about meaning making. I'm actually trained as a narrative therapist, and that's so it's not about fixing things. It's about retelling those stories so they become from a place of strength rather than a place of weakness. Although, in saying that, those are black and white words, and I don't mean them in a black and white way.
You know, in Russia, story's not a noun; it's a verb. Mm. So you don't tell a story; you story.
Yeah.
And that's how we make sense of our lives, isn't it? We have a narrative, we have a story of who we are and how that plays out. And I guess the arts give you a chance to play it out in different ways, kind of, well, maybe, it's that wonder, curiosity thing. where you can sort of be someone different for a bit, which is amazing.
Yeah. There's something very freeing, I think, just about, like, and I really love that idea of story as a verb, that once you start to kind of speak and organise your thoughts and kind of piece something together, that you'll see different moments in it, you know, that it will kind of start to tell itself. And I think that that's incredibly, like, therapeutic in a meaning-making kind of a way.
Yeah.
Like, it's freeing.
And as you get older, what happens is that, like, how do you link different moments in your life? Because, like, there are big bombshell moments in your life, the sonic booms that you were talking about at the beginning, that kind of sits in art. And then in the art you can relink them, put them up in different ways and reshape them and do that with other people. So the great joy of working with the Hobson Street Theatre Company, the moments in these people's lives, unbelievable.
You must hear some incredible stories.
Yeah, beautiful stories. Mm. You know, stories of wisdom and wit and wonder and joy and beauty. Yeah, magic stuff. Yeah.
Ross.
Wow. Yeah. That's really amazing.
Yeah. How have you got into where you are, you know, being a part of this four-person company and...
Yeah, okay, right, yeah. I mean, dance for me, primarily. I mean, that's it. And I guess it's... I was going to say it's quite a traditional route in North Canterbury, from a building site to for every man in New Zealand. I just followed that stream of men. I think it's interesting because I really love what you say about what art can pull out from within you and where it sits, where you sit with it. And it's interesting because there has a certain lonesomeness attached to it as well. And I don't know why I want to say that, but I'm not sure what it is, but if I think of poetry, what people find in themselves in a certain moments that art can pull out from them, and how it can, in a split second, feel like it can define you, and or how it can scare you, or how it can surprise you. You know, but for me, it started basically. I mean, I'm on a tangent there. I'm just reflecting on what both of you said, all of you said, which I find very inspiring. My brother was a musician and he played gigs, and his music was good, but primarily I started going just to dance there, and I was listening to him, and but at the same time I was getting my fill on the dance floor, that's for sure. And I realised that I was his biggest fan. He knew that, and he just didn't really know that primarily I was there to get my groove on, and that and he had certain songs that I'd be like, nah, I'm out. And then ones I'd go straight back in, he'd be like, that's your favourite, isn't it? I'd be like, yeah it is. And it was like, yeah, so it started there, I reckon, for me, and that progressed into I started to realise just how much I loved it. And I didn't realise until some friends had pointed it out to me. I was at high school and I was just organising a list of like the gathering, and all these new outside dance parties had kicked off, like raves. I mean, I'm talking about the 90s, and so, you know, they were kind of new, and they were happening in forests and everywhere, you know, wherever there was a cool kind of field, there'd be an all-night dance party with, you know, different DJs playing. And I just realised that I'd just be drawing up an itinerary, and I'd be going and with drink bottles and just dancing the whole night. And so I just progressed from there to something a bit more serious, and suddenly... Yeah, I sort of discovered ballet quite late, and contemporary dance quite late, and I just leapt to it. And that's a terrible pun, but it's true. It was unintentional, but I'll claim it. And anyway, I auditioned for the School of Dance, blah blah blah, and went there with about two other dudes, and look, it went from. I met some very inspiring artists during my time there, and quickly fell into the right place, and it seemed to work as an expression for me, movement, and I'm not quite sure why. It's definitely not in our family, dancing, but it seemed to really work as a way to articulate and express myself, and it's taken me all over the world to perform throughout, you know, America, Europe, right through to Moscow, anywhere. I don't know, I never thought I'd see the things that I saw through just articulating my body. But Yeah, it's like a landscape, I guess. So, yeah, and that's brought me all the way back here. And I'm still not sure how it began, but I'll get there.
Do you feel like there was any other option for you to go any other way? Because I'm hearing this really strong, like that you were just drawn to it.
I was drawn to movement really young. And I remember in the late 80s when breakdancing was in, I lived in Picton, and my mum felt very different about it. And there was the first time I could experience a conflict, maybe. Like, I was absolutely drawn to it, even the clothes they were wearing and the way that they were doing it. And I guess at that time, my mum was just like, that's bad. Breakdancing, street kids, bad. You can't do that. And maybe not realising why or how much I loved it. And so I think movement has always been there. There's been a lot of sport in our family, but I was always a bit scared and I never really told anyone. I used to play rugby and I actually didn't like the sounds... I know how that sounds, but I didn't like the way the dirt dried on my skins and how it used to feel on my clothes. And I would play rugby right up until the under-19s quite seriously and hold back a lot of fear that I didn't tell anyone. Like, I was always very intimidated by all the other players, the aggression, and I didn't seem to grow into that aggression very well. And I remember the dirt being a thing and how people thought it was quirky. Oh, he likes to have his hands clean, that's his tick for a good game. And I was like, I didn't say anything, but I was like, I just don't like the way it feels. But movement and physicality was always there. And so it was very, I'm just glad I found it on the dance floor. Yeah.
Cool. Now it is time for shameless promotion.
Right.
So if you wouldn't mind going from
I'll go real quick.
That really beautiful story this has just been such a fun show. I just feel like I could talk to you all for another 90 minutes.
Well,
let's just stay. No? It's getting pretty late.
I've managed to find... Muscle Mouth as a group has found an incredible bunch of dancers. I really mean that. They're extraordinary. And so this work has brought them together. There's eight of them. And it is a cast that if we kind of get this right and we get the size of this show right, the scale of the set that we're trying to build, the world that we're trying to put on stage, at the waterfront, and if we can pull this off, I think this will be really something that we can be super proud of, and it will be quite a spectacular, I believe. We've been sort of chipping away at this for quite a while, so and we're super honoured to be to have this opportunity through support from the Auckland Arts Festival. And so we're midway through right now, and there's some really great indications of where things are heading. And these dancers that are in this show, each of them are just, I mean, they're extraordinary. One of the dancers, he finishes with us, and then the very next day he's on a plane, he's straight to London to start work with Akram Khan. For those who know of him, he's like an extraordinary choreographer based out of in London there. And all of them just go straight into something else. So this work is a real great chance to see fully world-class dancers that are unbelievable.
Cool. Yeah. And it's 8, 9, 10
It's March? March the 8th, 9th, 10th, 7:30, I think. And it's a sort of, an hour and 10 minutes. And if you need, some more information to get tickets, you can visit the Auckland Arts Festival website, or you can visit our personal website, musclemouth.co.nz. Which is our company. You can have a look at that too. If you want a bit more precise background information on the work and some visuals or some pictures of how our rehearsal's going and what the dances look like and what the scene's coming together like. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. And it's well worth going and having a look at the Auckland Arts Festival website as well, because I just had a little squiz before I came in, and it's just overwhelming. They do an amazing job.
Yeah.
Also coming up, Fringe Fest. That's what Friends are for. Where can we get tickets? Where can we see it? When is it on?
You can get tickets through iTicket.
Mm-hmm.
February 27th to the 2nd of March at the Basement in here at Auckland. 8th to the 10th of March at Bats in Wellington. And we've got two nights in Dunedin. And I guess I'd say most people like me, before I started working with this crew, I just either walked past homeless people or worked my way around the city so I didn't have to walk past them. And I think a lot of Aucklanders do that.
Yeah.
Here's your chance to come, laugh with, sing with, cry with, get a little scared maybe in a show with a bunch of people who are there who really want to entertain you. So, yep, that's the plug. You'll be in a room with 20 people who are determined to make you their friend.
Sounds good. And we have Go Home Curry Mantra. I'm adjusting.
That's fine.
Yep.
Changing the Facebook page. So we start off at in Wellington, which we are playing at the Performance Arcade from the 21st to the 24th of February. So if you are in Wellington, come down and see us. We'll be inside Containers. And
it's
in Auckland.
On the Wellington waterfront. And so it's like a free bin. You can just walk right in. Yeah. It's on at... What time is it on?
It's on at 6:30 at night till 8 o'clock in Wellington. But in Auckland... We are playing at the Basement Theatre car park from 8 a.m. to 8:30. It's only 30 minutes. And it's on the 1st and the 2nd of March. And it is cohort entry. So if you don't book tickets, which is a great thing, I think. So if you come in, you feel like you like the show, you want to donate some of your extra dollar bills, just pop it in a container for us. If not, and you can walk away and you've got some free food and a free show after that. and you can find the information for Wellington at the Performance Arcade website. For the Basement, it's on the Basement website. It's on Auckland Fringe. We also have a Facebook page called Creative Creatures. If you want to follow us, we just started. We probably need a cheeky
like. Right now.
Yeah, and on Instagram as well.
Yeah, we're on the Insta, we're on the Facebook, we're not on the Twitter, but we don't like to tweet, but we do like to post some cool photos. And
I like your logo.
Thank you. And some interesting behind-the-scenes experiences, and we'll be posting more memes and more videos. So like our event page, which is Go Home Curry Muncha, and you'll find us... if you follow the trail of exotic spices at the Basement, you will find us playing. Awesome.
Thank you for coming in, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'll see you at your show on Thursday.
Yes. 8:30 p.m. Kaluzi Cabaret.
Yeah.
Drag queens galore.
And if people want the details, they can just type into Facebook the water cooler.
That's the one.
Comes up. Cool. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. It has been a great show. I can't wait to listen to it again. I always listen back to it because you miss little bits, you know, because I'm thinking about things. Really, it's been really fun having you all in. If anybody has, any listeners have a show that they would like to come in and talk to us about, just send us a message on kickarts1@gmail.com or otherwise on Facebook and give us a like. You will see the details for all of the shows that we've talked about tonight come up over the next couple of days so you can get a little prompt to go and order your tickets. Yeah, we'll be back next week. Richard and me, both together. It's been... I don't think I've done a show with him all year, so we're not that far into the year, actually, but it was probably December too, so it'll be really good to see him. Yeah, remember to go out there this week and kick some arts, everyone. Ooh, baby, love those reviews. Oh, reviews. Oh, reviews. Yeah.